Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. As we gear up for award season, there's no better time to join us. By becoming a Vanity Fair subscriber, you'll gain exclusive access to our in-depth coverage of film, television, and the best of Hollywood. And that's just the beginning. Vanity Fair takes you inside the worlds of entertainment, culture, politics, and scandal, bringing you iconic images, era-defining stories, and much more. Get 15% off a year of digital access to Vanity Fair by visiting vanityfair.com and using promo code POD15 at checkout. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a full year of insights and exclusive digital access. Subscribe now.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, an award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
It's such an honor to present this next award.
And here are the nominees.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
And I can't deny the fact that you like me right now. You like me.
I'm the king of the world.
There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
I'm senior writer Joanna Robinson, and I am joined today from remote locations by our digital director, Mike Hogan.
Hello, Joanna.
And from the snowy peaks of Park City, our chief critic, Richard Lawson. Hello, Richard.
Hello.
We get a live and in-person update from Sundance in this week's episode. I'm really excited to hear all about what you've been seeing.
Yeah, no, I'm obviously like mad from altitude sickness, so take everything I say with a grain of salt, but I have stuff to say.
Good.
It wouldn't be a Sundance report without a little bit of altitude sickness, but before we get into that, which is, you know, discussing potential award season contenders for next year, we still have some this year stuff to wrap up, starting with, you know, we got a lot of more information, a bigger piece of the puzzle this last Sunday. When the Screen Actors Guild Awards were held, they aired on TNT. We saw a bunch of actors go up and get their statues and maybe it cemented some narratives that we've been talking about for the past couple months. So I guess I will start with Mike and just ask sort of what was the narrative that you feel like most got set in stone by Sunday?
Well, I don't know if it's set in stone, but I feel like Rami Malek could win Best Actor, which I didn't really think was the case before this. Clearly, you know, the Screen Actors Guild members really liked that movie and gave him Best Actor over Christian Bale, Bradley Cooper, Viggo Mortensen, and John David Washington. So that's definitely a very good sign for him. And then seeing Glenn Close win made me think, okay, you know, she's in a good spot and very well could win that Oscar for Best Actress for The Wife. And then I guess maybe cemented is my notion that Mahershala Ali will win for Green Book. That seems at this point now fairly set in stone.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question really about Glenn Close now. I mean, I think that not only has she had these two kind of preliminary wins in the Golden Globe and now the SAG Award, but she's given like good speeches. And I think that now everyone's like, okay, like that's how we're voting this year. That's how it's going. Glenn Close is telling us a story and we have to hear the end of it, you know, toward the end of February. So that to me feels certain. Mahershala feels certain. Rami, I don't know. Like, I feel like that. I almost wonder if Christian Bale and Bradley Cooper are splitting a vote somewhere, and Rami is the one who's the kind of third place guy who kind of comes out the victor and all that, because like I don't know. I guess actors are weird. It's just everything about that movie's support, considering that, you know, the Atlantic article that came out about Bryan Singer, and I just am like, why are people holding on to this movie so tightly?
Richard and I both hopped like immediately on a you know, time zone delay, or Richard coming out of a Sundance screening, whatever it was, to give our maybe kind of cool takes on the SAG Awards on Twitter. And both of us zeroed in on the same thing, which is, when was the window of voting for the SAG Awards as compared to when the Atlantic article on Bryan Singer came out? And that Atlantic article detailing a number of accusations from young men about Bryan Singer's activities, rumored activities, basically, you know, a known rumor for years and years and years, came out 2 days before the SAG voting window closed. So probably most people had already cast their votes by the time that article came out. And it's not, to my mind, and your mileage may vary, it's not that Rami Malek should be necessarily held accountable for Bryan Singer's actions. Of course not. But the sort of the press he's been giving around it, which is just sort of a blanket, I didn't know, and the absence completely of any acknowledgement of it in his speech on Sunday, is both a strategy and one that I don't know if is going to rub Academy voters the wrong way, rub me the wrong way. The point that I was making on Sunday was, imagine an actress the last 2 years getting an Oscar for a Harvey Weinstein film and going up and not making any kind of acknowledgement of what that meant to some other women watching or anyone watching, you know? That would never happen. And so I'm curious if his SAG speech, you know, helped or hurt his cause on Sunday night. And I'm also curious, you know, as Richard pointed out on Twitter, like, how much these conversations are just between us and if they actually touch any of the people that are voting on these awards.
Well, I am going to ask a question. Did Cate Blanchett address the Woody Allen stuff during Blue Jasmine? I feel like that was her very successful strategy, was to just float above the whole thing.
Exactly.
Yeah, no, she mostly, she ignored it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And but I think even, what was that, 5 years ago? Like, even then, that was sort of more permissible somehow.
It was pre-Me Too, so yeah, that was a different era.
I think that, yeah, that's just like, it's kind of like my existential crisis this award season, where I'm like, wait, do the people we're talking about not care about the stuff we're talking about? You know, like, it's not an obliviousness necessarily. It's just a kind of like, they're just voting, you know, on different criteria than I think maybe sometimes we're having these discussions.
Well, I have a little bit of color to add to the SAG thing. Two SAG members, I'm not sure if they're voting members, but two SAG members that I know who are of a certain age, one of them texted me and said, we just watched Bohemian Rhapsody and we absolutely loved it. And I was like, wow, okay, I'm happy for you. And they're like, yeah, we smoked a bunch of weed and it was so great. So actors are probably, I would guess, more likely than anybody else to say, hey, we can't blame the actor for the actions of the director, and let's talk about the performance and not, you know, this other stuff that's outside of the sort of what's in the film strictly. But then I also, isn't there sort of a narrative out there that Rami fired Bryan Singer and kind of quote unquote fixed the movie? So he sort of has that going for him too, right?
That's the thing, is like, I think a lot of people see Rami as a sort of like folk hero in the Bryan Singer story, in terms of like, he got Bryan Singer fired. I think there were like 2 weeks left of shooting or something like that when he got Bryan Singer fired. Bryan Singer got fired for a number of reasons, violating certain contract agreements that he signed.
Right, and he sort of went
with
AWOL
Fox
for a while, right?
Yeah, he went AWOL, like all this sort of stuff. But, you know, by all reports, his treatment of his actors is not good. And Rami Malek was just sort of like, it's me or him, basically. And with all this movie in the can, what are you going to do? And so, yeah, I think there's a sense of the fact that Rami stood up to Bryan in that moment, and the fact that he was fired, so maybe that's like problem solved sort of thing, is maybe how some people view it. Of course, it's not problem solved when Bryan Singer already has his next project lined up. It's not problem solved when Bryan Singer is like on social media taking credit, even though he's not mentioned in any of these speeches, for all of Bohemian Rhapsody's wins. You know, if Rami Malek, once again, is not responsible for Bryan Singer, if he would acknowledge what this means, what this time means to not just a certain community, but like all of Hollywood, like if Me Too is important, and it is, then this is important because it is part of that. You know what I mean? And the fact that it's getting other, just because, I don't know, that they're gay men instead of women as your victims here is, you know, I think it's hard to watch, especially in the context of Bohemian Rhapsody, which is a story about like a gay icon. Like all of that is of a piece that makes it all, you know, really, really complicated.
Yeah, it's easy for me to kind of get lost in this sort of broader frustration. And then, you know, but you know, the heart of the matter is I've liked Rami Malek as an actor for a long time. And it's not the end of the world if he wins, you know, an Oscar for this movie that I don't think is very good and I don't think, you know, is directed by a good guy. So I shouldn't, like, I guess, freak out so much about it. It's just been an interesting season of disconnect, you know, and I think that maybe that's a kind of broader thing for me to think about, and other kind of pundits like ourselves, if we want to call ourselves that, to kind of think about. And I don't know, maybe I should be having more conversations with people who are actually in these voting bodies and trying to figure out like where their heads are really at before I kind of, you know, predict certain things that don't actually seem to be in the offing. I think it was also really interesting at the SAG Awards that we had a weird supporting actress category, because the still presumed frontrunner to win the Oscar, Regina King, for If Beale Street Could Talk, was not nominated at the SAGs for, I don't know, mysterious reasons. And so it was like, okay, so who's the runner-up there? Is it Amy Adams for Vice? People, I think, assumed that. Or maybe it's one of the actresses from The Favorite. No, it turns out it's Emily Blunt for A Quiet Place.
It was such a genuinely lovely moment, though, because as we chew over this narrative for months and months at a time, like by the time it, you know, the Oscars come around, it's either like the expected winner or like, you know, the person that, or the second expected winner, you know what I mean? And so for Emily Blunt to be a genuine surprise, her genuine shock, John Krasinski's like shock and teary face as he watched her like give her award, which all seemed like quite genuine to me. But what do I know? I thought was a huge highlight of the awards. What did you think, Mike?
Yeah, I mean, I'm very happy about it, just because I thought, I love that film, and I thought it was so innovative, and she's fantastic in it on every level. And I do think, you know, at its best, an award ceremony like this, where you've got a guild of actors who are seeing movies probably through a slightly different lens than certainly the press is, or even the way directors see it, or the way regular folks see it, it's fun because it highlights something and it makes you think, yeah, that really is an unreal performance, incredibly high degree of difficulty, dealing with all kinds of restrictions and restraints, also, you know, dealing with kids and dealing with violence and sadness and joy. You know, it was like, you suddenly think, yeah, good. I like that one, you know, and so that's what's fun, and that'll be the only award she gets for this role, presumably. but she should be proud of it.
It's interesting. We talk about Regina King still being the presumptive winner, and that's how I was feeling. But I like to bring these little dispatches from Katie Rich, because I'm sure our listeners miss hearing Katie's insights on stuff. And she was telling me, as she was sort of watching the SAGs the next morning, she was telling me that I guess Chris Rosen, who we've spoken about before, friend of the pod, what is his title at TV Guide right now?
I think he's the editor of TVGuide.com, yeah, or TV Guide.
Editor of TV Guide, Chris Rosen, apparently is known for his like wacky Oscar theories. And one he has percolating right now is not that Regina King's going to win, but that Marina de Tavera is going to win, and like for Roma. And that is,
get that one. He sends me some of his theories. He also thinks Black Panther's going to win Best Picture. Can we just roll out all of Chris's theories?
Yeah.
He told me he's 85% convinced that Black Panther will win Best Picture. But anyway, let's hear the Marina de Tavera one.
Well, let me ask really quickly, because Katie felt convinced. So my question is Katie just too far out of the game and like easily swayed right now? Or have Chris's wild predictions in the past come true?
Well, Katie is, you know, tending to two small children under the age of three, you know, so like that's probably going to addle your brain somewhat. But no, I mean, I think that the interesting thing about it is, if you think about the SAGs and you think about the Oscars in terms of, you know, what got nominated for the acting prizes, the actors are the biggest branch of the Academy, and they all voted to nominate for the four acting categories. And Marina de Tavera being in there for supporting actress represents, you know, just a sort of broad support from the biggest branch of the Academy for Roma. So I guess the question is, how broad is that support? Is there other support for her in other, you know, from other branches, that because everyone gets to vote on who wins? But then you look at the SAG Awards, which is all actors, and they're weird. Like, you know, they're surprising. And maybe that means that, like, Marina de Tavera could win, even though she wasn't nominated for a SAG Award, which presumably, you know, the actors should have been kind of thinking in lockstep. I don't know. It's all confusing how these things work, but I like that theory.
Apparently, according to Chris, he feels like there's a big surge for Roma, that Regina, you know, not being nominated for the SAG means something huge, which is so funny because, like, all along on this podcast, I've been like, it doesn't mean anything. But, like, maybe it does. I don't know. Chris has entered my mind, too. Anyway.
Well, you know what? I think we're going to have him. I just told him we're talking about this, and I think he'll come on next week. So we can let him explain it in full.
Okay. He can defend his ideas.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Well, let me circle back really quickly to that Black Panther notion of his. I will say this, like, if our idea after the Golden Globes is like a speech can earn you something, you know, then Chadwick Boseman's speech, which, you know, I would mark the highlights of the SAG Awards being, in my opinion, the Alan Alda tribute, the Emily Blunt surprise win, and Chadwick Boseman's speech for winning Black Panther. Those were my highlights. And like that speech at the end of the night, which is basically, you know, the SAG doesn't have a best picture, but they, you know, use their best ensemble sort of award to anoint best picture in their own way. Chadwick Boseman's speech about being, you know, to be young, to be talented, to be Black, is just was a very, very galvanizing, charming moment. The way he like didn't stumble too hard when Andy Serkis sort of popped into frame out of the corner of his eyes, stuff like that, was all just like made me at home want a Black Panther win even more than ever at the Oscars. So
my favorite SAG moment was being on a shuttle bus in Park City with VF's own Nicole Sperling, coming from a screening, going to VF's we had a party here with stars for a star show, and on the way to that and looking at our phones and Nicole just being like, what? Like looking at, like, I think it was like Emily Blunt's win or something like that. But I did go back and watch on YouTube, and I agree, Joanna, that Black Panther moment felt so good. In a year of kind of questioning it, you know, why are things winning and who's winning what, that felt sort of perfect in a way. It was like, yeah, that this feels good. So I wonder, you know, if that kind of moment and Chadwick Boseman giving such a great speech, if that affects, you know, how people vote for Oscars.
For me, it would genuinely, and I know I'm the comic book person, but like it would genuinely feel like such a good win because Green Book and Vice and Bohemian Rhapsody and like all these other frontrunners feel like so, there's just going to be so much debate and anger and frustration and joy and like all of that mingled together. Whereas like from where I'm sitting, Black Panther, this is like a feel-good win, I think. So I don't know.
Even Black Klansman is going to, you know, maybe create that kind of controversy on the other in the other direction, potentially. Although I haven't heard that many people complaining about Black Klansman.
Right.
But Spike Lee is generally kind of a divisive guy, you know. I mean, you didn't mention Roma, which would be a quiet kind of, I guess, crowning of an achievement, right? And we didn't mention A Star Is Born, which oddly at one point seemed like it was going to, you know, roll through everything despite its, you know, flaws. But now it seems like people are very focused on the flaws. So, yeah, I mean, Black Panther would be definitely probably the biggest feel-good win. I guess then there would be a big sort of cranking about comic books just absolutely taking over the whole world, akin to the popular Oscar debate. But it would have won fair and square the actual best picture, which is different.
I think so. I was listening to another film podcast that I will not call out by name, where they were all in a twist because they feel like Infinity War was the objectively greatest Marvel movie or comic book movie of last year. I think that's nonsense. I think Black Panther elevated, like I like Infinity War for what it is as a comic book movie, but like Black Panther, I really genuinely think elevates the genre. Ryan Coogler, you know, is just like a visionary director. And so, you know, the sight of Lupita Nyong'o bouncing around at the SAG Awards with excitement that they won is what I want to experience again on Oscar Sunday for myself. So.
Right. And I think, I mean, tell me if I'm wrong, you know far better than me. But to your point, it's not just that Black Panther is demographically different. It's a different take and tone and approach to a superhero movie that maybe has more in common with like Avatar than Infinity War in some ways. It seems to me, you know, Infinity War is just like the apotheosis maybe of that type of a movie. But this is a little bit of a different twist.
I think for me that the reason why Black Panther stands out among the other 22, you know, other Marvel movies is not just because it's a predominantly black cast and a lot of women are in it in central roles. It's the Marvel movie that really hones its political discussion into something really interesting because it's about, you know, this sort of long tail of colonialism and kind of American intervention in the wider world and what that means. And, you know, we want some reprisal for people who have been kept down, but also what does that reprisal look like? And, you know, Wakanda has this kind of interesting conversation with itself about we have all this technology, but we've been very secretive about it. How much do we share with the world? How much do we owe the world? You know, there's a really interesting kind of foreign policy discussion happening in that movie that the other Marvel movies, the Avengers in particular, have kind of poked at, but in a much more self-referential, like, what does a superhero mean kind of way. Yeah. But I think Black Panther considers a broader politic that, I'm not pandering to a movie and trying to like pump up a superhero movie's kind of politics. It really is smart on it, and it really does engage with it in an interesting way. So I think that's why, in addition to the kind of triumph of representation that the movie is, I think that's why it's connecting.
That's how I genuinely feel. There have been a couple movies recently that have really capitalized on this thirst to see representation on screen, and I would think like Wonder Woman and Crazy Rich Asians are both, you know, films that hit that mark. Those are both films that I enjoyed but would never put in the Best Picture category. And so Black Panther, it's not just about identity politics or anything like that. Yeah. I genuinely think this is a film that, as you say, Mike, it just goes above and beyond in terms of comic storytelling. I personally felt that same way about Logan last year, you know, so it's not the first comic book film to do this, but I think it is, you know, it has so much going for it and such a likable cast and team and all of that. So that is the win that I am back to rooting for, with like a director win for Spike Lee and a foreign language win for Roma. You know, like this, if I'm building my ideal Oscar, which we'll all have time to talk about later on as we get closer to the date. The other thing I want to talk about in terms of the SAG Awards is we saw, you know, the SAG Awards usually operate famously without a host. This year they brought in the lovely Megan Mullally to host. I thought it was like a pretty much a miss. Like I was like, I like Megan Mullally and I just did not need her there. It didn't add anything to the SAG Awards for me. And so I'm wondering, you know, in the context of the conversations we've been having about hostless Oscars, what the construction of that, like how that read to you guys.
It's interesting because, like, you know, a show does have to have some kind of crowd control, you know, like it has to flow. There has to be someone directing the transitions, right? And I didn't really watch the whole show. I kind of just watched like clips of Megan Mullally's, you know, kind of jokes, which were not great. But it did make me wonder, like, okay, so the Oscar no host idea is interesting because, Mike, you've been saying you open with a big song. Great. That's your opening. And I agree that would be the strong way to do it. But okay, but then what? How do we get from that point to the first award? Is it like, remember the years ago when Peter Coyote was like at this like round desk backstage?
Yes.
doing all the announcements? That was so weird. Like, is it like one of those things where we just have someone, some like voice of God being like, and now, you know, and maybe that works. But I do also worry that like the no host thing from the Oscars was not like a long standing plan that they really like honed and sort of worked with. It was kind of a last minute thing. So I think there's potential that the Oscars are a mess. Is what I'm saying.
Well, I mean, everything has been a mess so far. Now there's all this like anger and debate and arguing over the decisions to give below the line stuff during the commercials, and cinematography is now below the line. And you just think, what is going to be in this show? If there's no host, if you won't let three of the five song nominees actually perform, if you're having all the below the line things not happen on screen, like, you're really setting the bar so high that everything that happens on screen has to be absolutely fascinating and amazing, and it won't. It's going to be a bunch of mostly boring speeches. I just feel like this thing is shaping up really horribly. I will say one thing that I want to predict, possible prediction, is that there's going to be some kind of surprise host or group hosting thing at the beginning. I'm starting to think they're gonna bust something out and have, maybe they'll bring back some past hosts or something. I think they're going to probably engineer some kind of opening number. I don't know if you can pull that off, but in the world of surprise marriages and surprise babies and stuff, I feel like a surprise opener is not unthinkable.
Excellent. All right. So do you have any predictions about who you think would be in the surprise group?
I feel like, oh my God, I don't know. Next week, we'll come back to that.
Okay.
We should mention that we had been talked last week or the week before about a potential campaign save for Bradley Cooper in terms of performing places. And hey, what has he been doing lately, guys?
Now I'm getting hubristic. I feel like I don't think Bradley or any of the senior people involved in Star Is Born are listening, but I have a feeling some of the people who actually make it all happen are listening. And my fantasy is that they're going to their bosses, telling them what to do, and they're listening, and they're getting huge raises. this is my goal for all of you guys.
I just really like how many, I got notes both on Twitter and in other places of people being like, oh my God, do you think Bradley Cooper's team listens to Little Gold Men?
Right, so let's
look,
say,
he's trying.
Let's say what happened exactly. So Gaga was performing at the Garden, was it?
I don't know the venue.
And then Bradley came out and did a Jackson Maine thing, basically, and sang Shallow with her, right? And at one point, apparently, he air guitared, and somebody said you can really tell the difference between Jackson Maine and Bradley Cooper because the air guitar would have been cool if Jackson Maine had done it, but it looked kind of dorky.
Oh, I just think that, like, you know, and Gaga was giving him this, like, I don't know, a God has decided to join us sort of treatment. It was actually, like, I found the clips very charming and compelling. I mean, beyond the air guitar minute. And he actually, like, sounded pretty good. Like, you know, it's hard to sing in a large venue with monitors in your ears and stay on key and all that stuff like that. And he did okay on his harmonies and stuff like that. And I think, yeah, I mean, the notion that we brought up, I don't know, last week or 2 weeks ago, whatever it was, is that, yeah, last week, that it was like, if Bradley Cooper decided to run, he could still get this. And I don't know if that still feels true after the SAG Awards, but then, like, immediately,
I think it's still there, right? I mean,
all right, yeah.
Because Rami is, there's issues with Rami, starting with, you know, the fact that I think for certain discerning cinephile types, they are going to think that movie is not well assembled. And then I think something similar happens with, I mean, maybe all three of the movies that we're talking about aren't perfectly assembled, but A Star Is Born works, especially that first hour. That's all I'm going to say.
Yeah. So, I mean, I have been Team Bradley since I saw A Star Is Born. Like, of all the Best Actor nominees, I actually would be excited, like, the most excited to see him win. So, you know, if he wants to, like, go on Ellen again and be as charming as he can possibly be, and if that somehow gets him an Oscar, you know, at some point he's going to be like the Susan Lucci of the Best Actor category, right? He's been nominated a bunch of times, so we'll see. Or the Amy Adams of every category. Justice for Amy Adams someday, man. All right, so is there anything else we want to talk about in terms of the SAG Awards?
No, I mean, I think that as a means of transition, I'm going to say that, you know, we're joking about, you know, Bradley Cooper's people listening to the podcast and telling him, hey, you should get up on stage and do some singing. People do listen to this podcast. Like, I've been at Sundance now for, you know, just shy of a week. And, like, so many people have come up to me like, are you Richard Lawson? I listen to Little Gold Men. They'll, like, recognize my voice. And I'm not saying that to sort of, like, I don't know, brag or whatever. It's just like, Sundance, this is a concentration of, like, movie people, and, you know, that we are being heard, we should not take for granted, I don't think.
That's our target crowd. That reminds me of Cam tweeting, Cameron Collins, Richard's fellow critic, tweeting, I don't know why people say no one's watching The Wife. It seems to be on every screen on this plane that I'm on. And I'm like, dude, you're on a plane to Sundance. You know, like, it's not, but anyway.
That's a different kind of plane. Yeah, totally. Yeah, yeah, the Sundance Express.
I mean, I guess I could talk about TV, but I don't know. We're so far in the movie realm that I'm going to leave the TV SAG discussion for, I don't know, next time we talk about a major TV award. And I will instead pivot to asking Richard what we should be talking about already for next year.
Yes.
What Sundance films from last year's festival are still in the mix right now, Richard, for this current award season? None?
Like, none, really. I mean, eighth grade was kind of the big one that people thought might be the holdout. This is the first year in 5 years that a Sundance movie is not nominated for Best Picture. There was some question about whether 2019 would sort of, you know, correct that injustice, I guess, for the festival. I don't know that I've seen a Best Picture contender here. I wonder, you know, if others might disagree. There's one big film called The Farewell that I have not seen that was a big hit and just sold to A24 for, I think, like $13 million or something, that maybe seems like, because it's kind of a bittersweet family comedy with starring Awkwafina and directed by Lulu Wang, who's a second-time director, like maybe that could be, you know, one of those kind of moonshot Juno kind of Little Miss Sunshine Best Picture-y things. But I think otherwise this year's Sundance is more a narrative about interesting performances, and maybe those, some of those will translate to awards stuff in, you know, almost a year from now.
So what's at the top of your list in terms of things to point out?
Well, I don't want to shock you both, but I shocked myself by going to see a movie called Big Time Adolescence that premiered here at the festival on Monday afternoon. And I loved it, despite it being a sort of like raunchy, rowdy, and it's not really raunchy, but kind of, you know, very male teen comedy, starring as a sort of teenage boy's older ne'er-do-well friend, an absolutely wonderful Pete Davidson. It is such a good performance. I was like, what is going on? I tweeted out being like, huh, who knew? Like, it's so good. And people were like, yeah, no, he really is. Like, he plays this kind of, like, he plays a version of himself before he got sober, maybe, where, you know, he's kind of just like sitting around smoking a lot of weed, kind of getting in like mild amounts of trouble, being a sort of not great influence on this teenage boy who's the brother of one of his ex-girlfriends. It's a really cute lived-in story, and he just fills it so well. It's just such a natural. It reminds me a bit of like Tracy Morgan on that great show, The Last OG, where, yeah, you know, a sort of previously like directly sketchy kind of comedy actor reveals that they're also a really just a great actor.
Yeah.
And it, I don't know. I was like totally blown away by it. And I think a lot of other people were too.
Wow. Thank you. Next.
Yeah. So like, an Indie Spirit Award for Pete Davidson.
I mean, like maybe I think more likely he'll end up, you know, if I'm at the New York Film Critics Circle vote, you know, 10 months from now, he'll get some votes for like best supporting actor. You know, like I think that's as far as that will probably go. He'll be on some like people's list, but I think that the movie itself is really well constructed, written and directed by a first time director who used to be Nancy Meyers' assistant, which is interesting. It's a little bit too teen maybe to really connect. It's not, and not in a teen way like Lady Bird or something. Although I was speaking with Kenneth Turan from the longtime critic for the Los Angeles Times, who I hadn't met before, which is a nice thing that Sundance provides, is the opportunity to stand in line and talk to people like that. And he was like, I never go in for teen movies. You know, my grandkids are out of high school, and yet he also loved Big Time Adolescence. So maybe there could be more support for it than I think.
I feel like these like very charming Sundance teen movies are exactly the kind of Sundance movie that doesn't do well outside of Park City. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I was talking about it with some colleagues last night, is that comedy, so many Sundance comedies just like play really well here up in the mountains, and then when they get to sea level, everyone's like, huh? Like Me and Earl and the Dying Girl.
Yeah.
Patty Cakes, which was a huge sale to Fox Searchlight 2 years ago that completely tanked. I mean, then you do have your Junos and you do have your Little Miss Sunshines that do go on to connect. But it's a harder equation. And I think another interesting story here from Sundance this year, for those who care about like acquisitions and stuff, is what a sort of interesting market it's been. Netflix has not bought anything here this year yet, whereas Amazon has stepped in, New Line has stepped in, you know, sort of, you know, a couple other more traditional players. And I don't know if that's because they're trying to compete with Netflix or what, but there was a very big, broad comedy that played very well that was sold for $15 million to New Line called Blinded by the Light. And it's directed by Gurinder Chadha, who made Bend It Like Beckham 17 years ago, which is crazy.
Wow. Yeah.
And it's a coming-of-age thing in the 80s about a Pakistani boy who lives in Luton, which is this kind of like dead-end, I don't know, industrial town outside of London, who discovers the music of Bruce Springsteen and it sort of propels him into a new creative life and that takes him out of his town eventually. So it's based on the history of an actual guy. It's a sort of a based on true story sort of thing. And it's all this Bruce Springsteen music, and it played like gangbusters here. People were absolutely gaga over it. I was less so. I think the lead is really charming, but I think the movie itself has a lot of problems in terms of how it's constructed. But again, it went for $15 million, but I just don't know how that movie plays when you're not in the Eccles Theater with 1,000 enthusiastic people, if it has the same effect. And I think that we talk a lot about festival fever. I think Festival Fever is strongest at Sundance of all the festivals, and it's especially strong when it's a movie like that where people are tired and they just want something nice and comforting and they want good music and everyone goes crazy for it. But I don't know if that really translates to $15 million worth of acquisition money. And yet there it is. So I don't know. Blinded by the Light. Keep an eye out for it. It could be the next Sing Street, or it could be the next Me and Earl the Dying Girl. I don't know.
Can you explain to me what I was seeing in terms of like fake cockroaches being strewn about the floor of a certain venue in Park City?
It wasn't a certain venue. It was several venues.
Oh, okay.
It was, so Armie Hammer, who's kind of a weirdo, it turns out, is in a movie called Wounds, a horror movie with him and Dakota Johnson that I'm seeing it later this week. I think it's about a cell phone that's sort of possessed by some evil spirit. And it involves bugs somehow, which I'm sort of dreading. But Armie Hammer had this, pocket full of fake cockroaches that he's been strewing around the festival wherever he goes as a kind of weird viral promo for the film. And it's worked because you've seen it on Twitter, you know?
Yeah, I have. It works. It permeated. Excellent. And then I think the other big movie that I've been seeing people talk about is Late Night. There's been I think a little bit of division, at least in my Twitter feed, but you liked it, right, Richard? This is the Mindy Kaling film with Emma Thompson, and that sold, I think, for $13 million, something like that.
Yeah, it's great. I there are people who are like, oh, the jokes were too flat. This didn't work. This plot point sort of doesn't make any sense. And, yeah, they're not wrong. I mean, it's not a perfect movie, but I had such a great time at it. And Emma Thompson is amazing in it. It's so fun to see her with this big, chewy role to sort of tuck into and really make something interesting out of. And Mindy Kaling, who stars in it and wrote the film, she imagines this kind of alternate American timeline where a woman has been a late night talk show host for almost 30 years and is kind of at a weird career crossroads. And that's a kind of fun world to exist in. And it's an interesting backstage kind of thing about writers' rooms, and it looks great, and it has good music. And I don't know, I was so into it. And I think that something that maybe got a little bit lost in the discussion of that film, both positive and negative, partly because it is this glossy kind of thing. It's not a studio movie. It did enter the festival, for sale, but it's kind of aping Devil Wears Prada and other sort of big studio glossy kind of workplace comedies. Is that it's a movie that's both written and directed. The director is Nisha Ganatra, by women of color. And even though it looks so traditional, behind the scenes, there is something interesting happening. And past that, and the movie is this kind of gentle, I don't know, almost prescription for how in the immediate workplace diversity initiatives could kind of come about. And it's less about scolding Emma Thompson's character and more about opening her eyes to broader possibility and what she could stand to gain from including more people on her team. And so it's basically saying maybe if you appeal to people's vanity and their own, their own sort of fear of irrelevance, maybe that's right now a way to sort of get more people, more different kind of people hired onto these things, which I think is an interesting idea. And I like that a studio comedy kind of aspirant studio comedy like that is addressing that stuff.
Mike, is there anything that you've been hearing about from Sundance that you want to grill Richard on?
Yeah, I want to hear about the souvenir Tilda Swinton thing that you went for.
Oh, yeah, it's great. It's an A24 movie directed by Joanna Hogg, who is really, really revered in the British film world, but I'd never actually seen any of her movies. She made a movie called Archipelago. She's worked with Tom Hiddleston a bunch. So this is my first Joanna Hogg experience.
Mm-hmm.
But it's this really interesting memoir piece. It's really based on her own life as a young woman in film school in London. And it stars Tilda Swinton's daughter with Tilda Swinton playing her mom. And it's a great debut performance. And it's just a really beautiful memory piece. There's going to be a sequel already in the works about the next chapter in her life. And the Robert Pattinson fans on Twitter are so intense and dialed in. They were faving my tweets about this movie that he's not even in, knowing that he's in the sequel to it. The plan.
Wow.
So yeah, if nothing else, I've pleased the Pattinson fans by calling it the best movie at Sundance this year, which I really do think it is.
All right. Well, is there anything else, any other highlights that you want to hit that the Robert Pattinson fans can get excited for out of Sundance?
I'm seeing it later today as we record. It's Tuesday. I'm seeing it this afternoon. Alfre Woodard is in a movie called Clemency, where she plays a prison warden overseeing, I think, like her 30th or something execution, and so having a more kind of crisis of faith about that. I hear that Alfre Woodard is amazing in it. I'm very excited to see that. I would love an Alfre Woodard Awards narrative this year. She's long overdue. She got some nods back in the 80s, but it's been a long time since she's had that kind of recognition and, frankly, that kind of lead role. Keira Knightley is in a movie called Official Secrets, which is about the woman who was kind of the whistleblower about the U.S. and British intelligence spying on UN Security Council members in the lead up to the war in Iraq. She's great in that. Maybe that could be a thing. Oh, and then lastly, Annette Bening playing Senator Dianne Feinstein in The Report, which is about the torture memo and the kind of creation of that and the investigation into the U.S.'s quote unquote enhanced interrogation policies. She's great in the role. She looks exactly like her. Well, you know, she still looks like her, but they get the hair right. And it's a great supporting performance. But yeah, otherwise it's more been a festival about like crowd pleasing stuff and less Oscar-y, which is fine. I guess maybe I needed a little reprieve from the Oscar stuff.
Okay, so if you were to plant your flag, if you only get to pick one film or one performance that goes all the way to Oscars 2020, and I will hold you to it, you'll be fined if you are wrong. No, I'm just kidding. Who do you predict? Is it Alfre Woodard, Sight Unseen? Like, what is it?
No, it's Annette Bening as Feinstein, I think, because it's in a movie that is so righteously about something that like a rare good thing that came out of Washington in the last few years, you know, in terms of this report finally seeing, you know, the light, you know, coming to light, the public, you know, being able to see it about this really terrible thing that this country did not too long ago. And I think that helping her is the fact that not only is she playing a real life person, which, you know, the Academy loves, but also it's a senator from California. So, and I think Academy voters love nothing more than about stuff that's in their own backyard. So I think that could help it too. I know that Feinstein is not, you know, a universally beloved figure, but, you know, I think she should have enough support that people will like Annette Bening playing her. So
Yeah, she's pretty well loved in California. I will say this. Like, I think this is one of those, like, on the national level, people talk about Dianne Feinstein and they, like, occasionally when she comes up for re-election, they're like, oh, is this when California finally gets rid of Dianne Feinstein? And California's like, no, we love her. So, I mean, not all up and down the coast, but, you know, we like Dianne. We like that she's a senior member of the Senate. I think you've hit on something there. So, and you know, as long as Hillary Swank doesn't make a movie this year, then, like, maybe, you know, Annette Bening will be in the mix next year. All right, the last thing I guess I will urge you to check out, friend of the show, friend of the pod, Joe Reed, comes on every year to sort of talk about the things we thought, Richard's early Sundance predictions and all that sort of stuff. He has a podcast called This Had Oscar Buzz, and they just released their sort of in memoriam class of 2018 video for This Had Oscar Buzz, and it is a treat to watch. So if you go to @had_Oscar_Buzz, if you listen to this podcast, you will really enjoy that video and all the films that we talked about over the year that didn't make it into the nomination crop. Richard, until next week, until you're back from Park City, where can people find you in Park City?
Just, you know, stuck at the Eccles Theater watching movies. I'm at Ryalaz on Twitter, and I do have some reviews coming in from the festival. I also have a piece that I wrote for the magazine, a kind of introductory essay to the Hollywood issue that is up if you want to read about me and, you know, the last 25 years of my movie going. It's kind of a personal essay that I'm very happy with. So, yeah, go read that, please.
Yeah, and I mean, we should mention, as we have not, that the Hollywood issue of Vanity Fair is, you know, has had its online release. You will soon be able to buy it in stores. It's got just a really glorious cover. And I think people were really pleased with the Hollywood issue this year. It's my favorite Hollywood issue we've ever done. So I'm really, really excited about it. You can find me reading that over and over again in my home. Or you can find me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. You can find me on VanityFair.com. Mike is at Mike_Hogan. Katie, soon to join us again, is at Katie Rich. Soonish.
We're all at Littleville Bend, but that Twitter account, I think, is a little bit more abundant. But that's fine.
Yeah, we'll blow the dust off at Little Gold Men.
Yeah, and we should welcome our new producer and editor, Brett Fuchs, who's doing this episode, and we'll do hopefully many more to come. We were sad to lose Danielle Roth, but we're happy to have Brett on board.
And this week's award for the best reaction to this whole Oscar season goes to Mike Hogan.
Wow. Thank you. Next.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.